Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. It's been a while since we featured the inventive audio collages of the mysterious virtual renderings, also known as Chaz K. From his secret mountain redoubt, somewhere west of the Ohio River, Chaz issues occasional communiques in the form of very inventive collages of words and music. And we shall hear selections from one of them today. It's called Apocalyptine Tales. It's about America's economic crisis and political crisis, and the nature of freedom. Art is long, but time is short, so let's sit back and listen. Chaz begins the communique with The Matrix, J.S. Bach, and Noam Chomsky.
You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me.
Trade deficit is too large.
We must not go back to unwise spending.
This is America.
Madison, of course, the main framer, he argued that, he didn't put it in these terms, but he argued basically that democracy is a bad thing. It's dangerous. We have to make sure that the public doesn't become involved in public affairs. So there shouldn't be a democratic deficit. And he had a good argument. The model that he had in mind was England, of course. And he said, suppose that in England there was a functioning democracy. Well, then the large majority of the population would use their voting power to carry out what we would call land reform, to take land from the rich who concentrated in their hands and distributed themselves, mostly an agrarian society then. And he said that obviously would be unfair. It would be taking away property from the rich. So we can't accept that. He was raising a question that goes back to the first serious work on politics, Aristotle's book, Politics. Aristotle faced exactly the same question. I don't know if Madison was conscious of this or not. Aristotle considered the various kinds of political systems and their merits and deficiencies and decided that the least bad, he didn't like any of them, the least bad was democracy. But he noticed that there's a problem, namely Madison's problem. He was talking about Athens, if the poor in Athens could use their voting power, they would take property away from the wealthy, and that's unfair. So they were asking the same question, but they came to opposite conclusions. Aristotle's conclusion was you should get rid of inequality. And he outlined what we would call a welfare state, measures that could be used in Athens to eliminate inequality, so you wouldn't face the problem of the poor using their voting power to take property from the rich. Madison came to the opposite conclusion. He said what you have to do is eliminate democracy. That'll get rid of the problem. So the system that he designed places power primarily in the hands of the Senate, which is the most remote from the population of the various branches of government that were outlined in the Constitution. And he said the Senate should be the wealth of the nation, the more responsible set of men, those who have respect for property owners and their rights. And with that, and the rest of the population should kind of be fragmented and marginalized. And that way the government can meet its obligation, in his words, to protect the minority of the opulent from the majority. And that's essentially the Madisonian Compact, and it persists to the present. In fact, a good bit of the history of the last couple hundred years is the struggle between these two answers, Aristotle's answer and Madison's answer, right to the present. In fact, we have a huge industry in the United States. It's called the public relations industry, which is founded explicitly on the Madisonian principle. Its founder, leading figure, Edward Bernays, back in the 1920s, expressed the same view. He said that a power should be in the hands of the intelligent minority, and in order to achieve that, keep the public out of it, we have to carry out what he called engineering of consent, and that's the task of the public relations industry. He didn't explain how the intelligent minority gained that privilege, but the answer's not very difficult to figure out. By serving power, that makes you the intelligent minority, and then you can manage the society for their interests, following Adam Smith's principle.
I know what you're trying to do.
I'm trying to free your mind, Neo, but I can only show you the door. You're the one that has to walk through it.
Some say I need a driver, a Nixon mask and gun. But let me tell you, brothers and sisters, that's not how you get a bank job done. You can't walk in there brazen with a newsie like Patty Hearst. I'm gonna secure myself a seat on the board of directors first. Oh, that's how you rob a bank. I'll get some decent suits and a bogus business plan. Become well versed in the etiquette of Wall Street Disneyland. Hit the country clubs, eating peanuts and drinking scotch. Talk the recent trends and fart into a velvet couch.
Well, what about the banks and the investment firms? They're just as delighted as the insurance companies. And again, the business press actually expresses it better than I can, so I'll just mostly quote. You see headlines in the, say, the New York Times, in flurry of big merger deals, signs of restored confidence. Investors eager to take risky investments. The profits and bonuses are kind of off the chart. And in fact, why shouldn't they take risky investments? They're not risky. They've got a government insurance policy. There's a huge public bailout, no meaningful regulation, and there's a very significant increase taking place in the government insurance policy for risky investments and loans. It has a name, which you know, it's called too big to fail. If you're too big to fail, you get a government insurance policy. Well, bank has an insurance policy, sure, investment firm will take risky loans, risky investments, and make a lot of money, and if anything goes wrong, you pay for it. So, yeah, now it's more extreme than it was before the financial crisis. One of the really good economic correspondents, Gretchen Morgenstern of the New York Times, says too big to fail is just too big to take on. Deal with that. But you're getting too close to the centers of power. So here's the Washington Post, which says it a lot better than I can, so I'll read it. It says, headline, Banks too big to fail have grown even bigger. Behemoths born of the bailout reduce consumer choice, tempt corporate moral hazard. When the credit crisis struck last year, federal regulators pumped tens of billions of dollars into the nation's leading financial institutions. Today, the biggest of these banks are even bigger. The crisis may be turning out very well for the behemoths that dominate U.S. finance. A series of federally arranged mergers safely landed troubled banks on the decks of more stable firms, and it allowed the survivors to emerge from the turmoil with strengthened market positions, giving them even greater control over consumer lending and more potential to profit. These mergers were largely the government's making. Regulators pushed failing mortgage lenders and Wall Street firms into the arms of even bigger banks and handed out billions of dollars to ensure that the deals would go through. The oligopoly has tightened. It's only in economics departments that they talk about free markets, not in the real world.
Said Mr. Goldman to Mr. Sachs, "This fine little system is showing some cracks." Mr. Sachs to Mr. Goldman said, "We got it covered. Go back to bed." Mr. Goldman was reassured by Mr. Sachs. Bear Stearns went down, Mr. Sachs told his friend. And Lehman Brothers met a harsher end. Merrill Lynch was sold off via fax. A doer Mr. Goldman told Mr. Sachs. "It's time," Mr. Goldman said, "to pull some rank." "So presto," said Mr. Sachs, "we'll become a bank. We'll be covered by the payers of tax." Exulted Mr. Goldman to Mr. Sachs.
Mr. Sachs complained, "We're insured by AIG. Mr. Goldman responded, "That's fine with me. Our risky bets will be paid off in full," said Mr. Goldman, more than ever a raging bull. "Unemployment is rising," Mr. Goldman observes, "while their partnership is still thriving under profits in the billions. Ignore the attacks," says a flush Mr. Goldman to a flush Mr. Sachs. Speedy goes out of lights, Mr. Goldman and Mr. Sachs.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
The Matrix.
Do you want to know what it is? The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room. You can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work, when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
What truth?
George Orwell once wrote that the great enemy of clear language is insincerity. When there is a gap between one's real and one's declared aims, one turns, as it were, instinctively to long words and exhausted idioms like a cuttlefish spurting out ink. You've probably heard confusing phrases like the trade deficit, the falling dollar, the national debt, unfunded liabilities, and so on, which all sound vague and actuarial and vaguely, well, not me. The reality behind these accounting phrases is perfectly monstrous. When someone, a foreigner say, loans money to the American government, what are they getting in return? Well, they are getting promises of interest payments and eventual repayment of the principal. Where does your government get this money? The government is not a business. It does not generate profits in the free market. So where does it get the money to repay its creditors? Are you beginning to understand that it is not dollars that are being sold, or bonds, or agency debt, or treasuries, or anything like that? Where is your government going to get the money to pay off its creditors? It's not pieces of paper, or contracts, or computer bits that are being sold. There is only one thing that the government has to sell. Governments have only one asset that they can use as collateral. Your leaders are selling you. When China lends $800 billion to your government, what they get in return is a guarantee that $10,000 plus interest will be taken from your family at gunpoint and shipped overseas. When a farmer gets a loan from a bank, he uses his livestock as collateral. It is the milk and meat his cows will produce in the future that he will use to pay off his loan. The bank is buying a share in his cows. You are the livestock that your leaders use as collateral. The leaders that you cheer for and throw parades for and drop balloons behind and donate money to are selling you to Chinese rulers, to the Japanese, to the Nigerians, to South American drug lords with accounts in the Caribbean banking centers, to Russia, to Korea, to Egypt, to Colombia, to Chile, to the Philippines, to Malaysia, and anyone else who is willing to give them a few dollars in return for the blood, sweat, and toil of your future. The flag that you praise and the anthems that you sing and the rulers that you weep and kneel before have as much loyalty to you as a plantation owner had to his slaves. And sadly, plantation slaves had more pride than we do.
The United States has been attacked by a well-organized economic elite who are tactically destroying our way of life. They have paid off leaders of both the Republican and Democratic parties. They have seized control of the U.S. government, the U.S. Treasury, our tax system, the Federal Reserve, the stock market, and the U.S. and global economy. We no longer live in a society with a functioning free market. What we have now is a rigged market, and with that, a rigged government. The harsh truth is that the United States government has facilitated the theft of trillions of dollars of national wealth, and 99% of the U.S. population no longer has political representation. This sounds extreme, but I assure you that the evidence is now overwhelming. The economic elite have engineered a financial coup d'etat and have brought war to our doorstep. And make no mistake, they have launched an all-out economic war to eliminate the very existence of a U.S. economic middle class. Life is good. Unless we all urgently unite and organize on common ground and form a massive nonviolent movement, our very way of life and the ideals that our country was founded upon will continue to unravel at an increasing rate. Our nation is being raped and pillaged before our eyes.
By the election, you get your policies implemented.
You are a slave, Neo. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage, born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch. A prison for your mind. This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
Be truly free is both very easy and very hard. We avoid the horror of our enslavement because it is so painful to see it directly. We dance around the endless violence of our dying system because we fear the attacks of our fellow livestock. But we can only be kept in the cages we refuse to see. Wake up. To see the farm is to leave it.
Well, Madam Smith, he gave us this myth about how the market will self-regulate. But elite business schemes would still just be dreams without the arms of the state. If you wanna know what they mean when they say we're gonna open up your markets for our free trade, just ask the ghosts of all those who've been killed for refusing to bow down before the dollar bill. The invisible hand of the market is only one of two, wielded by the corporate elite and dressed in red, white, and blue. In one fist an M16 rifle, in the other one a $1,000 bill. If the right fist doesn't get you, then the other one surely will. Union Carbide, they go by so many names, but for the land and the people destroyed by their greed, the story is always the same. McDonald's requires McDonnell Douglas, United Fruit needed U.S. Marines. The freedom of their market, supported by fascist regimes. The invisible hand of the market is only one of two, wielded by the corporate elite and dressed in red, white, and blue. In one fist an M16 rifle, in the other one a $1,000 bill. If the right fist doesn't get you, then the other one surely will.
Another multimedia essay by the talented Virtual Renderings, also known as Chaz K. This one is on capitalist economics and politics, and its title is Apocalyptine Tales. On our website, you'll find a link to the complete hour-long version of this collage, and you'll find another link to Chaz K's complete works, all available for free download. Just browse on over to newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Today we heard from the likes of Noam Chomsky, Steph Bott, David DeGraw, J.S. Bach, Willie Porter, The Rolling Stones, The Eagles. Harry Shearer did that haunting song, Mr. Goldman and Mr. Sachs. We also heard from the movie The Matrix, and now in the background, Kate Boverman and Ethan Miller. That's all for today. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. Illegitimi non-carborundum. Please come back again next week, and ciao.
If the right fist doesn't get you, then the other one surely will.
They opened fire on the people, and these were true.
People since long have been listening to you for you.
This is CBC Radio.
We don't need no great hand coming down from the sky, or your soldiers in olive drab marching on by. To discipline, regulate, liberalize, legislate, we decline. Without you, we were just doing fine.